This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verse 255 of chapter Baqarah, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahu la ilaha illa
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Allah is He, besides whom there is no God, the ever-living, the self-subsisting, by whom all subsist. Slumber does not overtake Him, nor sleep. Whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth is His. Who is He that can intercede with Him but by His permission? He knows what is before them and what is behind them, and they cannot comprehend anything out of His knowledge except what He pleases. His knowledge extends over the heavens and the earth, and the preservation of them both tires Him not. and He is the Most High, the Great.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The death of a black doctor from COVID-19 after complaining about racist treatment renews calls for a debate on racial disparities in the US healthcare system. Syrian air defenses intercept missiles fired by Israel on the western province of Hama. Also ahead, rebel groups in the Central African Republic declare a three-day ceasefire ahead of the upcoming legislative and presidential elections. Welcome to World News. We're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story this hour, a black physician in the U.S. state of Indianapolis has died with COVID-19 days after she complained of what she called racist hospital care. Susan Moore, 52, died on Sunday, 2 weeks after she posted a video on Facebook. In that post, Moore accused a white doctor of downplaying her pain as he refused to provide her medication. Moore said that made her feel like a drug addict. She says she had received a CT scan after hours of pleading and trying to convince her doctor that she has breathing problems. Moore was given medication after the scan revealed that she was true about her condition.
You have to show proof that you have something wrong with you in order for you to get the medicine. I put forward and I maintain that was white.
Moore said she was speaking out so that the treatment she endured would not be overlooked. She had tested positive for COVID on November 29. Her case has renewed calls to fight what is seen as the biased medical treatment for black people suffering from coronavirus in the United States. Numerous studies have shown that black patients often receive treatment inferior to their white counterparts. Political commentator Alexander Azadegan says black Americans are three times more likely to die from COVID-19 than white people there.
We now live in a nation where doctors destroy health, lawyers destroy justice, universities destroy knowledge, government destroys freedom, the press destroys information, religion destroys morals, and our banks destroy the economy. I think it's a question of the ongoing struggle with getting adequate care in America if you're poor, regardless of color. In this case, the patient was not poor, but she was black. Another extremely overlooked issue in this country, Wessam, when it comes to minorities and the socioeconomically deprived people, is our healthcare disparity faced by black Americans, especially the poor people. Like I said, black Americans are three times more likely to die from COVID than white Americans. COVID has disproportionately affected blacks and other minorities in this country. The problem is that most healthcare providers appear to have implicit bias in terms of positive attitude toward whites and negative attitude toward blacks or other people of color.
A police chief in the U.S. state of Ohio has recommended the firing of an officer who fatally shot an unarmed black man earlier this week.
This is why today I am announcing action to terminate Officer Adam Coy. I have filed two departmental charges alleging critical misconduct against Officer Coy. After an expedited investigation, I have sustained those charges. Based on these findings, I am recommending discipline of termination.
Step to the side now.
The Columbus police chief said the officer unreasonably used deadly force against the victim identified as Andre Maurice Hill. The city's public safety director will hold a hearing on Monday to rule on the police chief's recommendation. The Tuesday shooting sparked a protest in the city of Columbus. It happened after police responded to a non-emergency report of a man turning a car on and off for an extended period. Body camera footage shows the officer shot Hill less than 10 seconds after finding him in a garage. The incident comes as anger boils in the U.S. over police brutality against the African-American community. U.S. President Donald Trump has caused more controversy by issuing a presidential pardon to members of the private security firm Blackwater, who were convicted of killing 14 Iraqi civilians in 2007. The pardon comes amidst a string of similar acts prior to Trump's imminent departure in January.
It seems that the incumbent US President Donald Trump is keen to leave his mark on the presidency by pardoning some of the most horrific state crimes, with yet more anger raised by his most recent action. In his latest moment of absolution, Trump has officially given a pardon to the private security mercenaries from the so-called Blackwater security firm, a US company shrouded in controversy and shame over crimes committed by its personnel in Iraq. During the incident in Iraq in 2007, four Blackwater security personnel opened fire, threw grenades, and used high-caliber weapons against a crowd of Iraqi civilians, killing 14 innocent, unarmed people, two of which were children. Following an investigation by parties including the FBI, the four guilty Blackwater murderers were sentenced to jail terms ranging from 30 years to life, something that many believe was too lenient, yet others thought were too harsh.
أتمنى من المحكمة الأمريكية بعد ما توصلت إلى هذا القرار قرار الإدانة أن تصدر قرارها بإعدام الجنات لأن هناك ما يقارب 20 عراقي أو 19 عراقي راحوا ضحية.
In spite of the crimes committed by the four men, many people in the US fought to seek a pardon for them long prior to Trump announcing the plan, with the lawyer representing the criminals, Brian Heberlig, suggesting that the four did not deserve to spend 1 minute in prison for their crimes. One can only then question the rationale behind the reasoning of both Trump and the lawyer of the four murderers, especially when it comes to allowing such acts to happen, only for the powers that be allow for the criminals to get away with a crime and the ending of 14 innocent lives.
Trump's pardoning of Blackwater contractors came 1 year after he pardoned two army officers accused of war crimes in Afghanistan and restored the rank of a Navy SEAL platoon commander who was demoted for his actions in Iraq. But with Trump having various links to Blackwater and other entities, his pardoning drive before his presidency shows Trump is hell-bent on using his authority to undermine the country's justice system.
There's a famous song that states that you can get by with a little help from your friends, and it seems that this is very much the case for the friends and partners of Donald Trump. Already Trump has pardoned some highly questionable figures in recent times, with many of them coming from the military or private sector background that enjoy close links to the president. Most recently, Trump has also pardoned Paul Manafort, Roger Stone and Charles Kushner, all close contacts and all sentenced for corruption and lies.
Thank you, Mr. President. Thank you for giving me the opportunity. Thank you for saving my life, because I don't think I, at my age and in my medical condition, I would have survived in a COVID-infested prison. The president has said on numerous occasions that he thought there was a good chance I could be exonerated. I agree with that.
But it's Trump's links to Blackwater that raises questions, with Eric Prince, the founder of the company, not only being a close ally of Trump, but has also acted as an official representative of the president in the past, something that clearly shows that there's a link between the pardon and the two close friends. Yet the pardon also comes as no surprise, as in reality, the victims of the terrible crimes committed have all been in US-occupied lands, suggesting that Trump is continuing his discriminatory policy against non-white people, something that Trump has certainly become renowned for over the years. But for Trump, there's no doubt that his famous motto of Make America Great Again has failed. And after 4 years in the White House and his seemingly effortless ability to divide the nation at home and create tension abroad, Trump's true lasting legacy will be MARA, or in its full form, Make America Racist Again. The one impact that Trump has been able to deliver on, it seems.
Syria says its air defenses have repelled an act of Israeli aggression in the west of the country. The Syrian Defense Ministry said Israeli aircraft targeted the Masyaf area in the Hama countryside, but most of the missiles were intercepted. It added that the attack was launched from the northern Lebanese city of Tripoli. Syrian TV aired footage showing air defenses responding to the Israeli attack. Israel frequently conducts air raids against positions inside war-ravaged Syria. The attacks are seen as a reaction to the Syrian forces' success in battling foreign-backed terror groups seeking to topple the Syrian government. Now, political commentator Kent Stone says Israel is part of the US-led coalition that uses terrorists in the hope of changing the government in Damascus.
We have to remember that Israel is part of the US-led coalition waging a war on Syria, an illegal war, in which the US and Canada and many other Western countries put terrorists into the country to try and force a regime change, and that failed. And there's only one province left, Idlib, where the terrorists are still holding sway. And the U.S. is also illegally occupying the entire eastern third of Syria with the help of their proxies in the SDF. And they are sitting on top of Syria's petroleum resources precisely in order to that the resurgent Syrian government does not have the resources available for reconstruction. So Israel is part of the game, part of the regime change game. They are failing. They are still lashing out, like the U.S., which is still sitting on Syrian oil. But the fact is that the Syrian government is going to win. It's going to retake every square inch of Syrian territory, as President Assad has said these long 9 years so far. And there will be a reckoning with the state of Israel. They will have to pay for all the crimes that they've committed against their Syrian neighbor, including the restoration of the Golan Heights, which is part of the sovereign country of Syria.
Elsewhere, rebel groups in the Central African Republic declare a three-day ceasefire in the run-up to the December 27 legislative and presidential elections. The coalition called on the government to similarly observe a truce over the period and urged President Fosson Arshans Tawadara to suspend the elections. They also accused the president of attempting to fix the vote. At the weekend, the government accused former president Francois Bozize of plotting a coup with the help of the rebels. Meanwhile, the UN has brought troops to the African country to help secure and monitor the elections. The elections are considered a key test of the conflict-torn nation's ability to regain stability. In other news, thousands of truck drivers remain stranded along the UK's border with France amid concerns over the spread of a new COVID-19 strain. The drivers have remained stranded for days now after the new variant surfaced in Britain. Authorities say the new strain spreads far more quicker, that is, than the original version. The truck drivers now have to take a corona test. Only those testing negative can cross into France. The time-taking process has angered the drivers who want to return home for the Christmas holidays. They complain about limited food and supply and inadequate bathroom facilities.
The conditions are chaotic at the moment. We had hoped to return to be with our families, but as you can see, they have thrown us here with nobody doing anything for us. So it looks as if we're going to spend it here on this motorway with our colleagues.
The drivers accused British authorities of subjecting them to what they call a psychological massacre. Others have called the conditions they face inhumane. France closed its border with Britain on Sunday, but eased some restrictions 4 days later. The UK and the European Union have finally secured an agreement over their future ties, setting the seal on Britain's referendum to leave the bloc. Bianca Rahimi has more.
Christmas Eve 2020, Prime Minister Boris Johnson signed off on an historic post-Brexit trade and security agreement with the European Union after an intense 24-hour negotiation period. A press conference expected early in the day finally came in the afternoon after lawyers and translators had crossed all the T's and dotted all the I's.
I'm very pleased to tell you this afternoon that we have completed the biggest trade deal yet, worth £660 billion a year, a comprehensive Canada-style free trade deal between the UK and the EU, a deal that will protect jobs across this country, a deal that will allow goods, UK goods and components to be sold without tariffs and without quotas in the EU market, a deal which will, if anything, allow our companies and our exporters to do even more business with our European friends.
A deal will mean Britain finally leaving the bloc's single market and customs union in a week, and freedom of movement will end. It also settles the future arrangements on a vast range of issues, from aviation and transport to civil nuclear cooperation and energy. The sticking points that took Brexit to the brink of no deal was access to British fishing waters, a contentious issue that prompted the UK to send Navy ships to the English Channel in case of clashes, and the level playing field, which is an important part of the EU single market, allowing for fair and open competition. The negotiations were very difficult, with lots at stake for many, and it was an agreement worth fighting for. It will allow us to avoid major disruptions to workers, businesses and travellers after January 1st. It will protect European interests, and this agreement is also, I believe, in the interests of the United Kingdom. It will lay solid foundations for a new start with long-time friends, and finally, it will ensure we can leave Brexit behind us. Europe continues to move forward. Despite the collective sighs of relief and resignation across Britain, the devil is in the detail. French media made waves in the hours leading up to it by asserting the UK had made huge concessions, something Westminster was quick to deny. Hardline Tory Brexiteers from the European Research Group have said its star chamber of lawyers will be convened to analyse the proposed agreement, suggesting it's not over yet. Bianca Rahimi, London.
And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver, Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
The Limelight.
In late night votes, just hours after nearly 5,600 pages of legislative texts were released, the U.S. Congress on Monday, December 21st, approved trillions of dollars worth of government funding and coronavirus relief that will temporarily avert a catastrophic expiration of key benefits, send $600 direct payments to many Americans, and provide billions of dollars in handouts to the rich. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Jake Johnson Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Pathetic, U.S. Congress passes COVID relief bill with billions in gifts for the wealthy and $600 checks for the working class. Here's the details of this article. In late-night votes, just hour after nearly 5,600 pages of legislative texts were released, the U.S. Congress on Monday, December 21st, approved trillions of dollars worth of government funding and coronavirus relief that will temporarily avert a catastrophic expiration of key benefits and send $600 direct payments to many Americans and provide billions of dollars in handouts to the rich. The entire Senate Democratic caucus and every Republican but six voted for the roughly $900 billion coronavirus relief legislation, which was paired with a $1.4 trillion spending package that will fund the federal government through next September. Just two House Democrats, Representatives Rashida Tlaib and Tulsi Gabbard, voted against the coronavirus relief portion of the sprawling package, which Donald Trump expected to sign. I voted against the latest COVID-19 relief legislation because it is woefully inadequate in addressing the needs of people, Tlaib said in a statement recently. I have watched as many of my colleagues rush to provide billions to corporations and wealthy individuals, while admonishing the needs of the majority of families. Republicans continue to do all they can to poison our society further with corporate greed, while abandoning the very people they are supposed to be working for, Tlaib added. This is evident by the inclusion of the three lunch tax giveaway. The tax deduction for business meals was one of the several giveaways to wealthy Americans stuffed in the mammoth legislative package, which was made available to read on Monday afternoon, December 21st, after reported computer issues delayed its release. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was one of the several lawmakers who publicly expressed outrage at the lack of time lawmakers were given to read the bill before voting on it.
members of Congress have not read this bill. It's over 5,000 pages, arrived at 2 p.m. today, and we are told to expect a vote on it in 2 hours, tweeted Ocasio-Cortez, who voted against a rule paving the way for speedy passage but ultimately voted yes on the coronavirus aid portion of the package. This isn't governance, it's hostage-taking. While the contents of the measure are still being calmed, progressives noted and denounced the inclusion of billions of dollars in gifts to wealthy Americans, benefits made more obscene by the bill's inadequate relief for people who are hungry, sick, unemployed, and facing eviction. Pathetic, said Senator Bernie Sanders, pointing to the bill's $120 billion handout to rich business owners and other provisions that will disproportionately benefit the wealthiest people in the country during the most unequal recession in modern U.S. history. The Vermont senator voted for the relief legislation, noting that the average family of four will receive a direct payment of $2,400. While including these direct payments ultimately improved this bill, given enormous economic desperation that so many working families across the U.S. are now experiencing, there is no question but that this legislation did not go anywhere near far enough, Sanders said in a statement. The $900 billion coronavirus relief package is a far cry from what economists say is necessary to bring the faltering U.S. economy out of recession and provide meaningful relief to the increasingly desperate public amid rising poverty and a major hunger crisis. Some economists are calling for a roughly $4 trillion package, warning that anything less would result in permanent damage to families and economy in the U.S. On top of the paltry direct payments for which millions of vulnerable people will not be eligible, the newly passed bill provides a non-retroactive $300 per week federal boost to the unemployment insurance and an 11-week extension of UI benefits, an extension accompanied by more burdensome documentation requirements for applicants who are already struggling to navigate rickety state systems. States will be asked to implement a significant number of new rules for these programs for a law that will only last 11 weeks, noted Andrew Stettner, a senior fellow at the Century Foundation. In reality, many workers won't receive the benefits until well into this short period, and at that point, the states will be forced to cut it off once again. Worst of all, Congress will be setting itself up for another 10 million plus worker benefit cutoff that will start in mid-March, before the new administration and Congress can be reasonably expected to pass another round of relief. Congress has given itself little choice but to immediately get to work on the next economic stimulus package as soon as Biden and the 117th Congress take office, Stettner added. That package must build on the CARES Act and include key reforms to make sure benefits are available as long as the economy remains constrained by this disastrous pandemic. Robert Greenstein, president of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, also raised concerns about the too short duration of relief and pointed to the bill's inadequate sick and family leave provisions. While the agreement continues the tax credits for employers established under the Families First Act for providing coronavirus-related sick days and family leave, Greenstein said in a statement, it doesn't extend workers' right to take that time off, leaving that to employers' discretion. A likely result, Greenstein warned, is that a substantial number of workers will be unable to stay home when they are quarantined or ill, or will be unable to balance work and family caregiving needs when schools are closed or a family member has COVID-19. Representative Ilhan Omar, who voted for the final relief package, said late on Monday, December 21st, that she is glad the legislation will provide direct payments that were not originally on the table, as well as billions of dollars in funding for schools. But that doesn't mean this package is anything close to enough, said Omar. $600 is not close to sufficient to cover 8 months of lost wages, food, or rent expenses. Mitch McConnell and his Republican colleagues have stonewalled state and local aid, along with survival checks that meet the scale of the crisis. This is a collective failure in helping Americans in their time of need.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
European News Bulletin.
From London, plenty to cover in this half hour, and we will begin here in the UK. Well, after 9 months of negotiations that have crashing through deadline after deadline, the United Kingdom and Europe have finally reached an agreement over security and trade, so Britain can finally end its EU membership. The announcement was made after round-the-clock talks aimed at getting a deal before December 31st. Now the 2,000-page document must be sold to Parliament and the British public, and businesses must start adjusting to the new ways of trading.
Christmas Eve 2020, Prime Minister Boris Johnson signed off on an historic post-Brexit trade and security agreement with the European Union after an intense 24-hour negotiation period. A press conference expected early in the day finally came in the afternoon after lawyers and translators had crossed all the T's and dotted all the I's.
I'm very pleased to tell you this afternoon that we have completed the biggest trade deal yet, worth £660 billion. A year, a comprehensive Canada-style free trade deal between the UK and the EU, a deal that will protect jobs across this country, a deal that will allow goods, UK goods and components to be sold without tariffs and without quotas in the EU market, a deal which will, if anything, allow our companies and our exporters to do even more business with our European friends.
A deal will mean Britain finally leaving the bloc's single market and customs union in a week, and freedom of movement will end. It also settles the future arrangements on a vast range of issues, from aviation and transport to civil nuclear cooperation and energy. The sticking points that took Brexit to the brink of no deal was access to British fishing waters, a contentious issue that prompted the UK to send Navy ships to the English Channel in case of clashes, and the level playing field, which is an important part of the EU single market, allowing for fair and open competition. The negotiations were very difficult, with lots at stake for many, and it was an agreement worth fighting for. Will allow us to avoid major disruptions to workers, businesses and travellers after January 1st. It will protect European interests, and this agreement is also, I believe, in the interests of the United Kingdom. It will lay solid foundations for a new start with long-time friends, and finally, it will ensure we can leave Brexit behind us. Europe continues to move forward. Despite the collective sighs of relief and resignation across Britain, the devil is in the detail. French media made waves in the hours leading up to it by asserting the UK had made huge concessions, something Westminster was quick to deny. Hardline Tory Brexiteers from the European Research Group have said its star chamber of lawyers will be convened to analyse the proposed agreement, suggesting it's not over yet. Bianca Rahimi, London.
All right, let's cross over to Westminster. Robert Carter is standing by. Robert, not really the kind of bluster that we heard the British Prime Minister a year ago give the British public. And everybody said if there was going to be a deal, there has to be a compromise or a fudge. Which of the two sides do you think has made that compromise?
Well, I think that the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson will take this as a form of victory. He did promise that he would get Brexit done and indeed secure that trade deal in order to finalise Brexit and to move on. However, the issue of compromise and who backed down, who are the winners and who are the losers, is being asked by journalists, particularly in the Q&A section after his announcement speech. And Boris Johnson seems to try to avoid mentioning where the UK has compromised to the best of his ability. So ultimately, the inquisition has now begun. Journalists, as well as legal experts and politicians, will be poring over the details. The overall document is believed to be about 500 pages or so, according to the British Prime Minister. So it won't be such a lengthy read as we originally suspected, but ultimately there are still room for criticism to be highlighted, especially from perhaps radical elements within his own Conservative Party, the hardline Brexiteers, who are going to be poring over the fine print to see if there are any major compromises that have been made that they don't like. But ultimately, areas like the fisheries, it seems as if the UK is claiming a victory there. That was a major contentious issue. But also, where will Northern Ireland be left after this trade agreement, and what relationship will they have in terms of trading with the UK? That could be a major issue. We have to see the details regarding that as well. But ultimately, Boris Johnson is claiming victory here. The EU admitted that they were sad at the situation that we find ourselves in, but both sides seem adamant that the coronavirus is having massive economic impact on both sides. And I think they both want to get Brexit out of the way now.
All right, Robert Carter at Westminster for us. Robert, thank you. Moving on now. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has met with U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Kelly Kraft, in Jerusalem al-Quds as part of an official visit. Netanyahu used the opportunity to thank the outgoing Trump administration for its, quote, defense of Israel. While in office, Trump recognized Jerusalem al-Quds as Israel's capital and moved the American embassy there, whilst also declaring the illegally occupied Syrian Golan Heights as Israeli territory. Both moves were condemned by the United Nations and the European Union. The meeting comes one day after Israeli regime's unity coalition collapsed, triggering the fourth election in 2 years. The fractured political landscape has meant no outright candidate is able to secure a clear majority. Be right back. Rising tensions between Iran and the U.S. Outgoing American President Donald Trump threatening Iran with war. Just how serious is the situation? Let's bring in Robert Inlakesh, who's been following that story for us. And Robert, this is a president known for being erratic, for being prone to making unexpected moves. What do you think of the whole thing?
Absolutely, and Trump is someone that's a bit of a wild card. You can't really read him. So to say that he would or would not commit an attack against Iran really would be silly. So looking at the situation, we do know that Trump has a track record of lying about responding to Iran, as he calls it. After the assassination of Haji Qasem Soleimani, Iran's top general, the response that Iran gave by hitting an al-Assad base, Trump stated that he'd hit 50-plus sites, including cultural targets inside of Iran as a response to that, but backed off and did nothing. Again, the U.S. military have positioned itself with, of course, placing a nuclear submarine into the Persian Gulf, been doing these flyovers over the Middle East with these B-52 bombers, etc. But meanwhile, back inside of the United States, the U.S. government has stated it does not seek war. Trump, though, last night just tweeted out photos of rockets which were launched, a number of them were launched on Sunday against the U.S. embassy in Baghdad. And he was essentially trying to link Iran and blame Iran for this attack when these attacks happen all the time. They've happened frequently this year, especially after the assassination of Qasem Soleimani and also Abu Mehdi al-Mohandes of the DMU. And so to link this to Iran is ridiculous propaganda.
What is the purpose of it all, Robert, very briefly? Is this about, as one Iranian official has been saying, distracting everybody from the fact that he's lost the election?
That could be part of it. Another, also speculated that perhaps Donald Trump does want to open up escalations inside of the Middle East with Iran specifically to basically put Joe Biden in a weak position to negotiate to get back into the JCPOA, and also maybe to stay remain in as U.S. president for a little bit longer.
All right, let's hear some public opinion on this.
The first one we have commenting on this here is a tweet here we got from a user called Steven, who says, "Friendly reminder before Trump does whatever crazy thing he's about to do to Iran. This is all his fault. He inherited a working diplomatic nuclear deal and thawing relations, blew that all up to try out maximum pressure, which predictably failed. And now here we are yet again." Another one here as well commenting on this, who says, "Make no mistake, Trump has already moved B-52s, submarines, and other military assets into the Persian Gulf. He is planning to start a war with Iran on bogus charges in order to prevent Biden from taking office. Iran is not the real target. American democracy is."
All right, let's move on to your second pick of the trending stories. Robert, after it withdrew its envoy to Israel in May 2018, over deadly attacks on the Palestinians in besieged Gaza, Turkey has appointed a new envoy to the occupied territories just a little over a week ago. Is this a thaw in relations, and what's the purpose of it all?
Well, it does seem that Turkey is perhaps moving away from its tight relationship that it had in the past with Israel. But when we look at Turkey as a regional power, it's very unpredictable, like Donald Trump, really. There is, of course, the pro-Erdogan power base inside of the country, but there's also opposition to this as well. Erdogan is seen to want to really expand Turkey's influence, to expand the influence of the country in general and his regime over the Sunni Muslim world, and sort of lead it and take on over from Saudi Arabia. And so what we've seen him do lately is really speak up a lot to the United Nations and other respective forums on behalf of the Palestinian people. The withdrawal of the ambassador in May 2018, again, was in response to a massacre of over 60 Palestinians on the same day that the U.S. embassy was relocated to Jerusalem al-Quds. And so this new ambassador is a pro-Erdogan ambassador, but at the same time, it's hard to predict what Turkey will do. At one minute it's friends with Israel, the next minute it's...
What do you say, and very briefly, to those who say that the path to Washington goes through Jerusalem or Tel Aviv, whatever you want to call it, that Erdogan had good relations with Trump, but probably not so when Biden comes to power, and because of given Israel's and Netanyahu's influence in the corridors of power in Washington, he is sort of pandering to Israel at the moment.
Absolutely. So we've seen as well, for instance, in Barack Obama's newest book that he spoke about how Erdogan was difficult because of the fact that he was so pro-Palestinian, and this presented a real huge problem in terms of relations with Turkey. And so, of course, this is a major thing. Even Russia, of course, it has a strong relationship with Israel. And to get to Washington and also to manage your policy in the Middle East, you have to, in some way, if you're one of these big powers, cooperate with Israel if you're looking to please the United States.
Let's see what this move by Turkey, what kind of reaction has got from social media users.
The first comment we pulled up here is saying that Turkey was the first Muslim country to accept Israel, but recently Turkey withdrew their ambassador from Tel Aviv. It's better that Turkey are taking a stand now more than most Arab countries. We Pakistanis hate the policies of Israel. We won't ever accept the invaders. Very strong comments there. And we got another one here from a user called Ahmed who says, just watch, Turkey will change its mind on its newly adopted harsher approach to Israel as soon as the price is right. Turkey has no principles. It acts like a European country. It looks out for itself first and does not stick to a solid foundation.
All right, Robert Nalakesh with those stories. Robert, thank you. To other news, a huge fire has destroyed a refugee camp in Bosnia. The camp had been criticized by rights groups because of its inadequate facilities and lack of resources. According to the UN, the fire started minutes after the camp was closed, leaving 1,400 men, women, and children stranded. There were no casualties or injuries, but the infrastructure of the site near the village of Lipa was destroyed. The fire comes months after the EU criticized Bosnian authorities for failing to provide enough protection for the tens of thousands of refugees who passed through the camp to reach neighboring European nations.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we cover the most recent developments all over Europe.
Following the Moscow-brokered peace deal between Armenia and Azerbaijan, the Russian Emergency Ministry has announced it has begun donating humanitarian aid to residents of Nagorno-Karabakh.
Today, the Russian Emergency Ministry has unloaded and delivered to Nagorno-Karabakh another 9 wagons of humanitarian aid, including construction and roofing materials, basic commodities, as well as electric generators and firefighters' vehicles.
On the 27th of September 2020, bloody clashes in the Nagorno-Karabakh region resumed, leading to a six-week-long bloody war that resulted in the death of over 5,600 soldiers and civilians. The fighting ended after the two sides agreed to a ceasefire. Russia has deployed nearly 2,000 peacekeepers for at least 5 years to monitor the agreement and facilitate the return of refugees. While the British government spends its time consumed by post-Brexit relations with the European Union and by the pandemic, issues which literally mean life or death for some people have gone largely ignored. One such issue is poverty. Charity organization Trussell Trust says that during the first 6 months of the pandemic, it distributed more than 1 million food packages. 470,000 of them went to families with children. And it looks like those numbers are on the rise. Karina was a working mom with a job in the tourism sector, decimated by the pandemic. With no savings to fall back on, and with her husband's delivery job earnings nowhere near enough for them to get by, they ended up in a position no one wants to find themselves.
I never knew about food bank. I just found out since I was on a financial difficulty.
Karina's quest for help led her to Educare Family Support Service, one of many publicly funded companies helping families down on their luck in the age of COVID.
We have lots of different food items that will go in. The plan behind it was that we would be able to prepare hampers for families who, disadvantaged families who may not be able to afford to have a Christmas meal or Boxing Day meal. So we've ensured that we've provided a hamper with everything excluding the meat. At the moment we're on about 270. Literally that is 270 families.
270 of many more families facing food insecurity and hunger, exacerbated by the pandemic, a situation that's drawn in UNICEF for the first time in its 70-year history in this country.
In these unprecedented times, I would imagine that these families have become known to their professionals that they're engaging with and are now require additional support.
This cavernous space is the interior of an Anglican church in West London. In normal times, it would see worshippers kneeling in prayer. Today, it's dedicated to something more pressing, getting food into people's cupboards.
I got quite emotional, actually, about, you know, just the thought that you are privileged and get to enjoy Christmas and then other people are going without, especially at the moment with these troubled times. So I thought if I can come and make just a little bit of difference.
These hampers are being stuffed with supplies to last families for a few days. People used to go to food banks to pick them up. Since the onset of COVID, the whole project of compassion has taken on a new dimension, deliveries.
These volunteer drivers will be dropping off food and presents at hundreds of households for the next 3 days, a drop in the bucket considering the number of families depending on these supplies. And some of those families have up to 6 children.
Most of these volunteers found out about this project on social media. Some of them have dedicated their only day off to being here.
To see the family smiles and the people who need the things is, you know, I can't explain what you feel. The smile of them faces just can give me the energy. They can make my day.
Some have brought their young ones along so they can see firsthand what their less fortunate peers are going through. Those with bigger vehicles have come as couples to help transport more of this humanitarian assistance to homes where kitchen cabinets are not restocked as often as they should.
It's nothing for me to offer a couple of hours, so we are also in a position where it could be me who needs this support.
This year has been very contrasting in the fact that there's some people just getting richer and richer and richer, and we're reaching rock bottom, really, and in sense of community is getting destroyed, really.
If you're feeding a family of 4 to 6 people, that's going to last, 2 days. It will get them through till Christmas Eve, hopefully.
And we all think we're struggling. Karina has had to adapt to her new world, caring for her 3-year-old daughter in a small rented apartment with no garden while her husband works, and looking after her ailing father who lives on his own.
I know a lot of people are suffering during this difficult time. It's very challenging, but you have to be positive at all times. Seek for help. If you don't ask, you don't get it.
Karina is perhaps one of the tens of thousands of families, if not more, for whom survival depends on charitable donations. Saeed Puriza, London. Yet another black man killed at the hands of U.S. police, this time in Columbus, Ohio, earlier this month. The city's mayor is now calling for the immediate termination of the officer who fatally shot Andre Hill. Richard Sudan has all the details. And Richard, thank heavens for body cameras.
Indeed. I mean, one of the interesting aspects to this case is that the officer accused of killing Andre Hill, Adam Coy, has been accused of having the audio off in footage of the incident, but the reality is this is another black man dead at the hands of the police in the US who was unarmed. And actually, this is the second killing in recent weeks within the Columbus area in Ohio. Of course, we saw the fatal shooting of Casey Goodson in recent days. Now, everyone, Saeed, is talking about video of the incident, which has gone viral.
And all that man was carrying, Richard, was a cell phone.
Absolutely, there's been no gun retrieved by the authorities, you know, in the area of the incident. And again, just to reiterate, there was no sound during that picture because there's a question about why the sound was actually turned off on the body cam. So there's a lot of questions being asked. The community is already starting to rally. You know, a lot of people are asking the question, how are the police allowed to carry out these killings? Where's the accountability? Where's the outcry? And actually, Andre Hill was left basically dead on the floor. The police didn't even attend to him at the scene when they should have. And again,